Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. A lot of people don't think much about libraries unless they need one, or they can't get a reliable, factual answer by asking their mobile device or smart speaker or friend on social network. So we'll open with the outgoing president of the Connecticut Library Association talking about these vital, localized, or specialized resource centers and the professionals who staff and stock them. Then we'll conclude our June Pride Month focus chatting with the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective, whose Connecticut LGBTQ plus movable senior center program has expanded to 24 senior centers across Connecticut, now offering events specifically designed for LGBTQ plus community members. And we'll kick off the first weekend of summer with a quick briefing from the Connecticut Department of Transportation. We'll cover a few basic summer travel and safe operating reminders. We'll tell you about the expanded emergency roadside assistance service that'll be available for you if you need it, and a new program monitoring speeding and issuing warnings and citations if you're repeatedly speeding through state work zones. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after these reminders. First, we have an addendum to one of our earlier Pride Month segments due to Route 7 construction affecting the Norwalk River Valley Trail entrance. The Wilton Pride and Norwalk River Valley Trail are rescheduling their push and pull Pride Month celebration that we promoted on For the People from later today to Sunday, September 24th, so we hope you'll be able to make it out. If you're looking for a patriotic celebration for Independence Day, the U.S. Army Field Band and Soldiers Chorus will be performing a free concert at the Stamford Palace on July 5th at 7 p.m. Tickets are free but limited, so reserve yours now by going to palacestamford.org. Well, looking back way beyond the three decades here at the award-winning For the People, and a couple more decades before that, I started to develop a love affair with libraries. I had one two doors down from my elementary school classroom. Ended up also utilizing one in my high school in Waterbury, and then went to work at one in Waterbury and another one out in Colorado way back before the end of the 70s. So my love and interest in libraries is very long and deep, as is that of my guest. I'm so pleased today to be talking about libraries in this opening segment with Doug Lord, an acquaintance of mine for several years in his position as the director of the C.H. Booth Library in Newtown, but he is also outgoing president of the Connecticut Library Association, which really brings together librarians, library staff, friends, and trustees to improve library services across Connecticut, and to also advance the interest of librarians and staff, and to also increase public awareness of libraries and library services, which is in part what we're doing today. We're also going to be talking a little bit about some of the latest challenges facing libraries and ways that you might be able to help them through friends, organizations, or direct donations, or just finding out if you can walk in and play a role in volunteering or writing a nominal check to designate toward improving or even starting some type of services. So, Doug, welcome to the program. Great to have you on the radio instead of in print for a change.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm really grateful.
So tell us just a little bit about your history. You know, you're back in high school, maybe college, and, you know, maybe thinking about what kind of a career you're going into. What inspired you to devote your life to libraries?
You know, it's a good question, and believe me, in high school and college, I was not thinking about libraries. I wasn't thinking about much of anything. There's usually two paths to librarianship, which, you know, if you work in a library, many people say that's a librarian, and I've known a lot of people without the advanced degree that's called the master's degree in library science who have been wonderful librarians. But oftentimes, when you're talking about librarians, you're talking about somebody with an advanced degree or even degrees, and they're experienced in running a nonprofit or operating at a high level in an academic institution, something like that.
Yep.
So the two paths are, oh gosh, I've been doing this primary career of mine for forever, and now I'm sick of it. What else can I do? And they turn to librarianship. Or there's a guy like me. I graduated with English literature from a, you know, at the time was not a fantastic school. It was UConn and Storrs. With English literature, and said, oh gosh, what can I do? And somebody says, why don't you look in the library science? And I went, okay, I'll do that. So I've never really had another professional line of work, which is freaky to me. I've been a librarian for almost 30 years.
Yeah, and that's interesting because the sum total of my time in the library, as I explained, sort of ended a couple of months into my freshman year of college, and then, you know, kind of never went back except as a friend and supporter. So that's very interesting. So in terms of libraries, I mean, I guess, you know, maybe 9 out of 10 people would think, oh, it's that big building downtown or out on the, you know, out adjacent to the town center, and they don't really maybe connect the fact that there's different kinds of libraries. We have a Connecticut State Library, certainly as I mentioned earlier, many, if not all schools of any stripe have some sort of library. Are there other types of libraries aside from, you know, either the municipal or school library or the big kind of statewide facility that does all the catchment of kind of the more official collectibles and documents?
Yeah, there are a few different kinds. And when you get a little bit specialized, it gets a little, I don't know, arcane, or, you know, it does tend to be very niche, I guess.
Sure.
But there are, there's like religious libraries, like rabbinical libraries in Connecticut and all over the place. The Vatican has one of the most incredible libraries in the world. But there's also prison libraries, which they kind of wax and wane with whatever political forces are at foot right now in Connecticut. The Connecticut prison libraries are on they couldn't get much more restrictive in terms of services and stuff like that for the inmates. But you also have to consider, like you mentioned, schools and academics, and those libraries serve not just the students, but also the learning population of whatever that community is. So if it's a prison, it's also like the staff that work there and the teachers that work there. It's a resource center.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with schools. It's not just for K to 12. It's for all of the teachers and the administrative staff. And most of the time, academic libraries in any kind of good sense, in a large sense, is mostly for faculty, and the students they play a much more secondary role, which is something people might not think about. And there's also different kinds of corporate libraries as well. So they're more and more on the desktop, more and more digital these days.
Yeah.
But most major insurance companies and major defense companies have quote unquote libraries. They're huge resource areas that are under the intellectual control of that company that help those staff people and engineers and stuff like that get really super duper specialized in what they're doing.
Yeah.
Art libraries and museums, there's just all kinds of different cool stuff.
Yeah. So, well, you know, over the years, you know, since the late 1980s, early 90s, when the internet started to really, you know, come into its own, I would hope then as well as now that professionals associated with libraries still kind of, you know, keep a quiet smile to themselves because, Google is what Google does, but as you mentioned, you know, the R word, resources, when it comes to, you know, Google, it's AI and algorithms that are helping you, but libraries actually still deliver the human touch to anyone who is seeking resource. And that really is what continues to elevate libraries to their very unique and important position, whether it's in prisons or schools or communities or in industry.
Yeah, it's true. Librarians, the person that is a librarian, our essential job when we're on the reference desk is to improve the quality of the question. So John Boquette might come in and say, I need a story about XYZ, or, you know, I need resource material on whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not going to assume that we're not going to make any kind of assumptions. We're going to, like, ask you a whole lot of questions in as short amount of time as we can to identify exactly what it is you need, and sort of telescope it in from the very, very broad to the very, very specific. And oftentimes people do come into libraries not really knowing what they want. It's not a very well-formed question, or it's a question they haven't thought about. They have a need, but they're not exactly sure how to express that need. So then we use our incredible library science tools to sort of help them identify, well, what is it that you actually want, and how can I help you in the future? So there's also a sort of a willingness to return to the library, mm-hmm. or the staff person to continue that relationship as a help, as an institution that can help in all sorts of areas of life. It's not just the one thing you came in on. You know, it could be like, I needed a book. Its cover was red. It was written in the 1980s, and it dealt with, you know, it was a mystery to do with sewing or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, they have a question about the medicine they're taking. So we'll point them at resources about that, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, high quality resources from something like the National Network of Libraries of Medicine.
Sure. Not what some,
Joe Blow's cancer.
Yeah, it says on a social network or may refer you to because they're getting paid to influence that decision. Unbiased, unpolitical, unvarnished facts, and relevant, reliable, trusted resources is the key.
I couldn't have said that better.
Yep. Yeah. Well, one of the things that you have been kind of peripherally embroiled in, and libraries in Connecticut and across the country are starting to face, is this, this escalation of community members who want materials removed. So as far as the Connecticut Library Association or yourself, you guys have been a pipeline for some really important and factual statistics. And I'm just seeing from the American Library Association as late as about a month ago, reporting the record number of demands to censor library books. So this has really cast librarians and library professionals like yourself sort of into a not only the front line of a new great American controversy, but, kind of into a game that, you know, I wouldn't say you're not equipped to play, but shouldn't be playing, given the fact that we have our First Amendment rights and access to these materials, right?
Exactly. Nobody goes into librarianship for money. Neither do they go into it because they're a belligerent person looking to fight with people. We're looking to help. You know, it's honestly, it's a helping profession. And I never thought I would see a lot of things in the United States become politicized, but I never thought I would see reading become politicized. If you like a book, if you want to try to check a book out, if you want to, you know, explore some knowledge or a topic, check a book out. If you don't want to do that, then don't do that. Same thing with a program. You don't want to go to what sounds like a program that is not for you, then don't go. But believe me, the library is putting on the program because either people have directly asked for it, or they're tapping into some sort of zeitgeist of the community where people are curious, and there's a hubbub about this topic. And it's almost never a controversial topic. It's things like, you know, Botticelli's late stage paintings, or, you know, how to grow your daffodils better, something like that. Yeah. But any aspect of human life is going to be represented in library programming, and that's part of my job. I mean, that's in my job description. Yeah. It's in all of our job descriptions.
Well, is there in the schooling and development of operational protocols, is there sort of a general process that is followed or at least is available as a roadmap for virtually any library when it comes to considering and selecting and shelving material?
Well, it's not anything that's universal in terms of like the Ten Commandments, thus shall, you know, it shall be so.
I got it. Yeah.
It has been declared. As librarians, we're trained to, as we talked about, identify resources that are of high quality, are recent, you know, that have factual, accurate information, that are in good shape. You know, they're actually attractive. They're not falling apart. They're not full of, I don't know, stains and mold and stuff like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So to a certain extent, it's really just money that holds me back from shelving all sorts of, you know, if I could jam-pack the library, or, you know, if librarians in general could jam-pack their library with every book in the world, they certainly could, but none of us have the space or the time or the money or the resources to do that. So we make a lot of judgment calls. That's essentially what we're doing every day. And it does kind of take a lot for a library, for a book to get onto a library shelf. It can't be too terribly out of date. It can't be factually inaccurate. It can't be some sort of like polemic that just is not something that is of wide appeal, you know?
Yeah.
So, and libraries will always, every 100% out of, I'm sorry, 100 times out of 100, libraries will reflect the timbre of their community. So if it's a conservative community, most of the books on the shelves or the materials, the movies, whatever, they're going to reflect that. They're going to be more conservatively based, or there's going to be some more conservative types of authors included. If it's a liberal community, it's going to be that way. But we're always going to try to present as best we can balanced viewpoints that consider everybody in that community. And again, that's part of my job too. That's in my job description. That's in every single document that makes my library a public library. It's in, like, in Newtown, it's in like the town charter or the library bylaws, or like it's in the Connecticut State Constitution. It's in the United States Constitution that I shouldn't, I will not, I cannot discriminate, that I have to present, meaning that I have to present all of the different viewpoints that represent all of the population of the community that uses my library. Now, you know, say you're working in a religious community and there just isn't any, there's no call for alternate viewpoints, then probably you're not going to stock that stuff. But any public library is duty bound to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes generally for school, K to 12 libraries, where they're serving not just the students, but they're serving the academics and the staff and the administrative people, the sort of student adjacent folks. It's, you know, easily half of the population of that quote unquote community. So it's important.
I was going to say, if we, in the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Doug, I just want to remind people that if they are interested in learning more about dealing with censorship challenges wherever they are, they can go to the American Library Association, ALA.org, and just look for the big red banner right across the top of their homepage and visit their Fight Censorship page for various resources that can be used. But, excuse me, in your case, you know, like I said, in a minute or two, if there was one point that you continue hearing echoed somewhere out in the world, that is a complete misconception when it comes to the whole argument of what individuals feel should and shouldn't be shelved in a library. You know, what's the biggest thing that kind of keeps you up nights in terms of, oh my God, so many people got this all wrong?
Well, I mean, I guess librarians come down on this one point. Citizens or, you know, members of the community have a right to redress of their government. So we will listen. Librarians will always listen. We'll always have ultimate consideration for people's opinions, and we will take that into consideration. No librarian is pushing an agenda of any kind. We're stocking books for popular material libraries that people have asked for or want to check out. So we're perfectly happy to discuss. We're great at bringing people together to, you know, to discuss these sorts of things. So I think more communication and less knee-jerk reaction and just thinking about, well, that doesn't belong in the library, is the way to go. People have every right to read and think what they want, especially parents, as they consider what their children are consuming. But the same people do not have the right to tell other people what it is that they can or should not read. So that's essentially the nutshell version of that.
Oh, good.
People in the U.S. have freedom of choice.
Excellent. Well, good way to wrap things up for today, Doug, and appreciate the conversation and always open to promoting libraries wherever they are. We thank you for your time. Doug Lord is the director of the C.H. Booth Library in Newtown and the outgoing president of the Connecticut Library Association. You can visit ctlibraryassociation.org to find out what's going on locally in libraries, or just walk in to your local library or a library near you and explore. Your librarians and library volunteers and operators would like nothing more. Doug, thanks for your time. Well, the next in our Pride Month focus here in June is going to be a subject that it was of acute interest to me, because while we've talked a lot and kind of generalized a little bit about the LGBTQ plus community, we haven't really focused a lot on a unique demographic within that community, and those are those of us who may be aging and members of that community. And I was so thrilled just a few days ago to receive some communication from the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective, who announced an expansion of the Connecticut LGBTQ plus Movable Senior Center program coinciding with the celebration of Pride Month. So I got on the line and was pleased to connect with Sherry Ostrout. She is the Connecticut Community Care Director of Government Initiatives, as well as a representative and spokesperson for the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective, who we've heard from a little bit on a prior segment of For the People. So thrilled to have you, Sherry, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here, and thank you for uplifting this wonderful, wonderful initiative.
So first of all, you know, for folks that may be listening live as early as the 5 o'clock hour on a Sunday morning or up into the early mid morning, let's quickly just talk a little bit about the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective and how it sort of overlays or fits within your work with Connecticut Community Care.
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. The Connecticut Healthy Living Collective is an initiative of Connecticut Community Care. We have the great honor of serving as the strategic and operational entity and fiduciary for the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective. The Connecticut Healthy Living Collective is really a growing network of organizations and people who really came together to work collectively and to build on and achieve a vision where Connecticut residents have very easy access to programs, to services that really promote healthy aging and enhance social connection. We work together to share knowledge, to build programs, and ultimately to have the biggest impact we possibly can on well-being and equity outcomes here and across Connecticut.
So as the state as a whole begins to proportionately age into a larger demographic of seniors, so too does the so too do the LGBTQ plus members of that demographic. So I was thrilled in chatting with you before we turned on the mic to learn that this initiative really harkens back to 2015. Have you been in some way tied to this initiative going back to its humble roots?
Actually, yes. Back in 2015, a group of individuals, advocates, again, organizations, people who were just really interested in this, came together and watched a very powerful movie called Jen Silent. You may have heard of that. The director's Stu Maddox. It's a documentary from 2010 that tells the stories of, in this case, three older adults. And it really highlights the struggles of people who identify as LGBTQ and how, as they age, many really need to go back into the closet to receive care. And it really had a tremendous impact on Connecticut. It was really a galvanizer for us. Speeding ahead, the group came together and thought, you know, how can we really make a difference in Connecticut? And one of those initiatives that sprang forward was a pilot initiative that we labeled the LGBT Movable Senior Center. We've now evolved to LGBTQ plus Movable Senior Center, where five greater Hartford senior centers came together and around a common theme, wanting to bring training to senior centers to make sure that their centers were as inclusive as possible, trying to get a good mix of what programming might look like. So, for example, when we sit down and talk about things like end-of-life care or financial planning or various caregiver support initiatives, often there really needs to be a twist to be relevant to the LGBTQ community. Not all topics are fully generalizable. Various populations have specific needs, and that goes same with the LGBTQ population. So let me just keep fast forwarding. Of course, the pandemic hit. We went to online and virtual programming, and here we are after incredible success and interest. We went for it and went for a full-blown expansion. Today, we have 24 senior centers who, during Pride Month here in June, through the course of the year, have committed to being a inclusive senior center and be part of the network of the LGBT Mobile Senior Center and stand up and actively promote and foster a fully inclusive environment within their senior center.
So really, in just 7 years' time, this initiative has grown five times over, which is a spectacular success rate. But certainly, 144 or so communities left to go. Still a lot of opportunity out there. And we'll talk to leaders, hopefully, through this program in many of those communities who hopefully will reach out to you to try to connect once they hear some of the benefits and outcomes that we'll continue to talk about, Sherry. You wanted to kind of start the conversation around some interesting or perhaps even some concerning statistics around the aging LGBTQ plus community. What can you tell us?
Well, first, when we talk about statistics, I hope people don't turn the knob, right? They are fairly compelling. So thank you for bringing that up. I think it's important to just recognize that LGBT older people really came of age at a time when being openly gay could get them arrested, could get them fired, or even worse. The experience of discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity happened on many, many fronts and was even condoned by society in the form of laws and policies and norms. What we know is that about two-thirds of older people, LGBT older people, have experienced some form of victimization at least three times in their life. That's important. Now, overlay that with other things, right? Often, and this is why we built this initiative collectively, is that LGBT elders are significantly less likely than other older adults to reach out to senior centers and other health services and social services, including meal programs and other vital services, because of this stigmatization and discrimination experience. Now, I'm making general research-based comments here. Mm-hmm. This doesn't apply to every single individual, but in general, accessing programs and services offered through senior centers and meal programs and others are somewhat avoided because of fear of discrimination, not perhaps actual discrimination, but because of fear. But to be as responsive as we possibly can, think about this. About LGBT older people are about 2 times more likely to be single and living alone. They're about 4 times more likely or less likely to have children, and are more likely to face poverty, homelessness, have poor physical and mental health. Often caregivers are those who are friends and chosen family, because at times LGBT people may have experienced rejection from their own families. So what you're seeing is a lifetime of discrimination and stigmatization that has resulted in poorer health outcomes for older LGBT people, as well as a heightened sense of social isolation and really a smaller network. So it's really important for all of us, society, to tune into that and create programming and experiences that are targeting and reaching out deliberately to LGBT folks and bringing them into our spaces in a way that's safe and creating an environment that's welcoming to all.
Oh, that's,
and that's exactly what the senior centers are doing. Very proud of them.
Great. Well, let me just say now for folks that are listening, we're going to take a brief break and we're going to come back and talk more about the specifics of this program with Sherry Ostrout. She is the Director of Government Initiatives for Connecticut Community Care, which is also a part of the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective. Did I get that right, Sherry? Community care is part of the collective, or collective is part of the community care?
A little of both. Yes. Okay. The Connecticut Healthy Living Collective is an initiative of Connecticut Community Care.
Okay. So suffice to say, Sherry Ostrout and I will be back right after this break. Stick with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. You've heard Choose Love Movement founder Scarlett Lewis on our program several times over the years, so we want to remind you that a Choose Love Movement fundraiser is happening at the Blue Heron store at 852 East Broadway in Milford on Friday, June 30th and Saturday, July 1st from 10 to 5. 100% of proceeds from all sales on both days at the store will be donated to Choose Love. This is the annual June fundraiser to honor Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting victim Jesse Lewis. Refreshments will be available. There'll be a coloring contest for kids and all kinds of other activities. If you'd like to know more about the event, the coloring contest, and what the movement might be able to do for you, your family, your school, business, or community, just visit chooselovemovement.org. All right. Well, we're back with Sherry Ostrout of Connecticut Community Care. She's Director of Government Initiatives, as well as a spokesperson for that organization's subsidiary, the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective, or special project, whatever, whatever way we may choose to describe it. Bottom line is that as we have been talking about this important relatively new development, now labeled the Connecticut LGBTQ Plus Movable Senior Center Program. We've gotten the full raft of background on why an initiative of this type is so important to members of the LGBTQ Plus community who are of the age where it may be of most help to them. So Sherry, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about what this program looks like today and how the current 24 member senior centers are tapping the partnership with your organization to maximize its effectiveness and efficiency.
Excellent. Well, again, the 24 senior centers, maybe we can even name them at some point. They have committed to not just providing events, one or two events throughout the year, but each senior center has invested so much of their time and personnel. Every person who interacts with older adults in the senior center, including the van driver, the receptionist, to get specializing, to learn more about the experience of the older LGBT person and perhaps what they've gone through. They've also learned about how to handle specific incidences. Hopefully this doesn't occur, but from time to time it can. Bullying, getting a better understanding of transgender issues, as well as learning about ways in which they can generally be more inclusive through having visible symbols like a pride flag or a decal or the forms and the data that the senior center collects, how to create and be more inclusive in their data collection. So I'm underscoring that because the senior centers aren't just, and I don't want to say just, but aren't just providing programming and events, but they're also investing so much of themselves in having a better perspective and a deeper understanding of what people have lived through and what matters to them. So what that has brought us to is 24 senior centers have raised their hand. They've gone through that training. They continue to invest in ongoing learning throughout this year through fantastic experts within and outside of Connecticut. And they have committed to providing events in a coordinated way around the state. We call it the Movable Senior Center not because it's a van that drives around, but because these events are rotating through various senior centers throughout Connecticut. And the senior centers are willing and able and have committed to welcoming people who not just live within their town, but also outside of the town in which their senior center serves. So this large-scale schedule of events. It starts now in Pride Month, June 2023. It runs through June 2024, and then we'll be boosting another calendar of events that begins next year.
And I was going to say, so we know that in many cases, senior centers, especially those that may be smaller, and maybe that's not even correct, but many senior centers, if not all of them, do structure programming and a fee schedule to welcome individuals from outside of their community, sometimes with programming that may cost a few dollars versus being free for seniors within the community of the center, or they offer sort of like a member and non-member structure. So are you finding that over the course of this program since 2018, as the number of participating centers have grown from the initial five to the 24 currently, which we'll shout out in just a few moments, that they are also attracting and drawing individuals from the LGBTQ plus senior community to their centers, even if they're not members of the community those centers serve?
That's absolutely right. In fact, what we see is people are absolutely traveling to these events. Waterbury, people living in Waterbury, traveling to Newington. You know, where you find community and community for whom you relate and you find a supportive space, people are traveling, if they're able, of course, if they're able. And that's why we want this to expand, because what's the most meaningful is to be able to go to your backyard next door within your town and within your community to go to the senior center there and feel welcome. I do want to say, John, that even if a senior center is not part of the LGBT Movable Senior Center, it's very possible and likely that the senior center is open and affirming as well. But the 24 senior centers that are part of this network are the ones I'm speaking to.
And those are Avon, Berlin, Bloomfield, Cheshire, Coventry, Cromwell, Glastonbury, Granby, Groton, Hebron. Hey, out there. Hebron, Madison, Manchester, Mansfield, Middletown, New Milford, Newington, Plainville, South Windsor, Southbury, Torrington, Vernon, Windham, Windsor, and Woodbury. Many in our listening area, and just a few that may be able to tune in one or a couple of our stations here for the people. But we appreciate the initiative that these 24 have taken to really step up in partnership with this Movable Senior Center program. So, Sherry, I guess in closing, kind of going way back to the beginning and some of the stats we talked about, not only do the members of the oldest generations of LGBTQ plus seniors, not only have they on average experienced three incidents of, you know, some sort of a negative happening around their choice and their sexuality, but, you know, some of the oldest members of these senior communities come from the generations where, in fact, you know, the discrimination may have been accepted or even encouraged. How are you finding that particularly your 24 partner programs are doing in bringing those who may have been a little bit discriminatory or a lot discriminatory in their younger days against the younger versions of the LGBTQ plus members who are coming to the centers?
Right. Really good question. You know, the senior centers have been tremendous in anticipating and thinking about worst case scenarios and preparing for them. Gratefully, in these instances, any kind of incident hasn't really risen to the top where anyone has felt major threats or any threats or harassment thus far, certainly not any assaults. But I think the best thing that can happen, and senior centers are actually beginning to do this, is create some more global training and conversation around just some basic, you know, level setting kind of conversation. You know, what does transgender mean? Why are people talking about pronouns? My grandchild has come to me and said that they are gay. What do I do about that? You know, how do I engage in a conversation so I don't bumble and stumble? And if I do, and if I do make a mistake and offend somebody, what do I do about that? So senior centers are amazing, first of all. And the professionals within senior centers are not just exceptional at program planning, but at people. Rest assured that these are conversations that are happening, trainings that are happening, and it's really a journey for each senior center as well to not just have this targeted programming for LGBT older adults, but fostering a inclusive and a space of belonging for everyone in their community.
Since 2015, the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective has expanded its CT LGBT Movable Senior Center program to be the CT LGBTQ Plus Senior Center program, and are included in 24 senior centers, as we just named, across Connecticut. If you'd like to find out more about the LGBTQ Plus Movable Senior Center program and events that are going to be continuing throughout the rest of this year and into next June 2024, or learn more about the Connecticut Healthy Living Collective and anything else they might be able to help you with in terms of resources, just go to cthealthyliving.org. Their representative on our program this morning is Sherry Ostrout. She is the Director of Government Initiatives for Connecticut Community Care and the spokesperson for Connecticut Healthy Living Collective. Sherry, great to chat with you, and thank you so much for all the time this morning. Summer is here. That's right. We celebrated it about 11 o'clock last Wednesday morning. And since summer is here and we're heading into the first big kind of official holiday weekend of summer with the 4th of July looming, it is appropriate that we call on our friends at the Connecticut Department of Transportation. Josh Morgan's on the line with me to talk about a number of things. So Josh, I guess, you know, we talk to people like you, we talk to people like Connecticut State Police and local public safety and responders, and I'm sure it is uniform. Nobody wants to go out to a crash, large or small. It's always going to cause somebody a problem if it's a fender bender, but when it becomes a matter of life and death, and it's compromising other people's safety on the roads, that's when I'm sure it starts keeping you up at night. So from the DOT's perspective, what's the boilerplate message coming into this summer in terms of operating safely on our Connecticut roadways?
Yeah, it's pretty simple, John, and thank you for the opportunity to be on the program. It's drive sober, it's slow down, it's pay attention. There's a serious problem in Connecticut with a high rate of impaired driving, the incredible risk that people are putting themselves and others at when they're texting and driving, when they're watching YouTube videos on their phone and driving, and when they're speeding. And we're not talking about 1 or 2 miles an hour over the posted speed limit, but 30 or 40 miles an hour over the speed limit. So it's just dangerous, reckless, selfish behavior that's happening on our roadways. And we need people to realize that it's a privilege, not a right, to operate a motor vehicle. And they need to do so sober, and they need to do so at the speed limit, and they need to be paying attention at all times.
Yeah, it seems amazing to me that so many people want to fall back on the safety technology that's now available in contemporary vehicles. The assumption that the the traction control and the avoidance mechanisms and the airbags and the anti-lock brakes and other various safety components that are standard backup cameras, all that stuff is going to help protect them or even save them in the event of a crash, but it still comes down to the operator.
100%. I mean, we fully support those advanced safety features, the lane detection assist, the cameras, obviously the airbags and the seatbelts. You know, those are all incredibly important, but when a crash can happen in just a matter of moments, taking your eyes off the wheel, driving impaired, which would slow your reaction time and your ability to operate that vehicle. Those advanced safety features help, but they're not the end-all be-all. So the operator really is bearing the responsibility. And it's important to remember that those in cars, you know, they're surrounded by thousands of pounds of metal and steel, and they have the seatbelts, they have the airbags. But we need to look out for our pedestrians, our bicyclists, are really vulnerable roadway users who don't have those protections.
Right. Good point. And we'll leave this aspect of the conversation just reminding people that Connecticut's back seat, all point in-vehicle seatbelt law is now in effect. So no matter where you are in a moving vehicle in Connecticut, front seat, back seat, third bench seat, you need to be seatbelted in. We've covered that, Josh, extensively in an episode in the segment we broadcast about a month ago. So not only are people sometimes wanting to go faster after they've had to go slower, but when that usually happens, it's either because there's a crash or there's construction going on. And as you spoke about the extreme escalation of high-speed driving in Connecticut, you just played a role in a release that came out a couple of weeks ago about a pilot program for construction zone speed controls and speed cameras. And the results of that affirmed what you said about speeding, but not just speeding, speeding within 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 feet of a cluster of workers who are busy making sure they're safe doing what they're doing and can't be paying attention to vehicles that might be, you know, speeding within inches of them, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, earlier this year, we launched the Know the Zone Speed Safety Camera Program. It's the first of its kind in Connecticut. It's a pilot program, which is automated speed enforcement in work zones around Connecticut. This isn't 24/7 enforcement. These speed cameras are only active when workers are out there on the side of the roadway. It's a program to raise awareness about the dangers of work zones, to raise awareness about the risk that people are putting themselves and others at when they're speeding through work zones. And it's a way to reduce the number of crashes that happen in work zones. You know, in the last 4 years, there were more than 3,600 crashes in Connecticut work zones, which killed 13 people and seriously injured nearly 40 more. So these are, you know, what we call preventable crashes. They're, you know, attributed to speed. They're attributed to distraction. You know, these are crashes that don't need to happen if people are just slowing down and paying attention behind the wheel.
So how did the pilot work? Thousands of vehicles sighted in just the few locations in critical or strategic areas of the state where these, you know, sort of the test program vehicles, these movable monitoring vehicles were stationed.
Yeah, it's, you know, so over the last 2 months, we've been in six different locations. These are SUVs, so they are mobile. We can move them in different spots. We're going to be all over Connecticut. The pilot program runs through the end of 2023. But the data that we're having right now is showing that one in six vehicles are speeding through a Connecticut work zone. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going over the threshold to get a citation, which is 15 miles an hour over. But still, they're breaking the law. The work zone speed limit is there, whether it's 45 or 55 miles an hour, to slow people down and keep the workers and the drivers on the roadway safe. So seeing that one in six, just about 100,000 cars over the last 2 months have been speeding through work zones is alarming. And we're hopeful that this program will raise awareness of the dangers of doing that, and we'll see those numbers decline as the year moves on.
And do you see this program becoming potentially permanent?
So it required a special legislation, which is sunsetting at the end of 2023. So our promise to the Connecticut residents and also to the General Assembly is that we're going to prepare a report. We're going to analyze, you know, what the speeds were in work zones before the program started and what happened over the course of nearly a year during the program to present that report, present those findings, and you know, we're confident that it's going to show that it did slow people down and it did reduce crashes and save lives.
Great. So so individuals who may be guilty of high-speed movement through a construction zone that's being monitored may see some sort of warning if they haven't gotten one already?
Absolutely. If someone's traveling 15 miles an hour or more through a work zone, if they are speeding, they're going to get a warning. Again, this isn't a gotcha program. It's not a revenue-generating program. It's a public safety program. So the first time it happens, it's a warning. And we hope that that's going to be enough, that we won't have to issue any citations out. But if someone does it a second time, it's a $75 citation. Third and subsequent violations are $150 each. But you know, right now, we've issued more than 1,300 warnings and not a single citation. And that's really good news in our minds, because that means that people who have gotten those warnings, you know, haven't done it a second time. You know, maybe they're getting the message and they're slowing down when they're going through these work zones.
Very good. Well, another way that a potential resident or traveler through Connecticut can have a bad day on a Connecticut roadway is with a breakdown. And I know that the state of Connecticut and the DOT has a fantastic partnership with Geico Road Patrols, which has been re-upped for the summer of 2023.
Yeah, the DOT Highway Safety Patrol is a free service provided by the Connecticut DOT. It's sponsored by Geico. It's actually 15 specially outfitted pickup trucks that are, as the name says, patrolling. They are driving across all of our state routes, all of our state highways, looking out to see if there's debris in the roadway, if there's a motorist on the side of the roadway, trying to get people back on the road as quickly and safely as possible. It's not a service that people can call and request. So if someone does break down, if they do have a flat tire, if they do need assistance, you know, please call 911. But that's when the state troopers or our highway operations center may see somebody out there, may hear from somebody out there, and we can dispatch that safety patrol to them, who may be able to get there quickly, more quickly than a trooper or another first responder. So again, it's a great program. It's a free program. And what we see in the summer is, you know, calls for service, requests for service, the amount of people that are being helped by this program increased by more than 25% because of how much roadway traffic is out there given the summer travel season.
Very good. In the final minute or two that we have with you, Josh Morgan, the Connecticut DOT played a critical role in the development of legislation that just passed in the recent session in Hartford that created something called a Vision Zero Council. Now, I know we could spend probably two segments talking with just you and other DOT folks about the ramp up, but we certainly will be returning to talk to you or some DOT folks along with a bunch of others who are involved. But for people that are starting to hear about Vision Zero Council and the legislation that's tied to it, you know, in a nutshell, what is it that this is about?
Yeah, three main takeaways. First, some extra driver re-education. It's a while to think about when you get your license, you just renew it in perpetuity without learning new laws, without learning what's changed on the roadway. So every other license renewal, being able to get some little driver re-education, ask the DOT to do increased effort to raise awareness about the dangers of impaired driving. But I think what's getting the most attention is a provision of the bill which is going to allow towns and cities in Connecticut to develop plans to implement automated traffic enforcement, red light cameras, speed cameras in areas that are school zones, high crash zones, pedestrian zones. So that would, again, be a first of its kind program here in Connecticut, which could start as early as 2024.
And in a home rule state, that puts the power or wherewithal to initiate and control the information from these cameras on municipal roadways in the hands of that municipality.
Correct. The local legislative body of that municipality would have to come up with a plan. They'd have to vote in favor of the plan after having public hearings to hear from their community members. That plan would then get reviewed by the Connecticut DOT. And because this isn't a program to be a surveillance state or to be at every corner, every intersection in every part of Connecticut, that program would sunset after 3 years, and then a community would have to go through the same process again to re-up the traffic enforcement. So again, we think that's a program that will help slow people down, will help reduce crashes, and ultimately save lives throughout Connecticut.
Excellent. Josh Morgan is a spokesperson for the Connecticut Department of Transportation. Lots to talk about that we packed into this brief interview here on the first full weekend of summer. Folks, please heed Josh's and the Connecticut DOT's and the Connecticut State Police and all your local and regional emergency responders' advice. Do not drive impaired. Slow down. Be aware of your surroundings. Drive defensively. Josh, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion. It's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.